Does anybody have any questions? Any satsang questions? I was thinking when I was doing that meditation. Anyway, when I was doing the meditation, I've been thinking about a lot about the Mandukya. And what Gaudapada is trying to do in the whole Mandukya is to kind of do what I was trying to do in the meditation, which is to really look at your experience, because it's not the creation of a new experience. It's an analysis of the experience that you're having, and that's supported by the vision of the Upanishads. So he's taking the Mandukya Upanishad, and then he's doing a huge logical unfoldment. But when we say logical unfoldment, we shouldn't look at that as something which is just theoretical. The logic itself is making sense, logical sense, of the experience that you're having. So it has to be rooted. Everything that's being said has to be rooted in your experience so that the words are actually landing there, and then you're seeing it and you're saying, oh, yeah, that is true, or, well, is that true, or how is that really? And then there's some question answer and that type of thing. So you're really analyzing the experience that you're having, because there's not going to be a new experience. A new experience of yourself. You know? And in fact, when you think about it like that, any so-called new experience is going to be something objectified within time and space. So I can have lots of new experiences within time and space, but what's similar about them is that they're all objectified. They all come and go, you know, and I remain. Any new experience or any repeating experience, right? It comes and goes, and I remain. And so that's an important thing to recognize. And this logic, I didn't give the Sanskrit for it, it's called anvaya-vyatireka. It means when the anvaya shows a relationship. When this thing is, that is, there's a relationship. So that's a positive assertion of a relationship, anvaya. When this is, that is. But I still can't say there's a relationship, because I have to has to also hold true in the negative. That's the vyatireka. When this is, that is. But, you know, what if I said when this is, that is, but when this is not, that still is. That negative destroys the relationship, as though there's some sort of a bond there, some bandha, some sort of a connection between the two. If I said when this is, that is, and when this is not, that's not. Then in positive and negative, I see there's a sambandha, a connection, right? But if I can say when this is, that is, and when this is not, that still is, then there's no possibility of a connection. If that's just coming and going, and I'm still here. So if you take even just looking at this life itself, from your birth to the present, there are countless experiences that have come and gone on every level. The only one that hasn't come and gone is you, you know. So if I was to say, you know, the little baby girl was the 6-year-old, was the 10-year-old, you know, what do I mean by that? I mean, the baby is certainly not the 6-year-old, certainly not the 10-year-old, certainly not the 60-year-old, but I'm present as the self of all of those experiences. I'm present as the self, right? But since all those experiences have come and gone and they negate each other, you know, when this one is, that one's not, they negate each other. When this thought is, that thought's not, they negate each other. When this emotion is, that emotion's not, they negate each other, you know? But I'm the self of all of them. So what relationship can I have to them? I'm free of them, kind of like space. We use that example of space, you know? Like if I move a pot through space, from point A to point A, B, the space is not moving. The space is a sangha. It has no connection. You might think there's such a thing as pot space, but there really isn't. Right? The pot exists in space. There's no pot space. Not really, otherwise. What are you going to do when you move the pot? The pot's carrying the space around with it, leaving a hole in the space or something. It's not how it is, and we know that. But we don't understand the reality of that in terms of our own experience. And if you really sit with it and contemplate on it and apply your own logic and your own mind to it, what you have to come up with in the end is actually these experiences, as intense as they may be, as positive as they may be, as negative as they may be, have nothing to do with me. They're not adding to me, and they're not taking away from me. They can add to the upadis, you know, like for instance, within duality, if I decide to go on a diet, I'll lose weight. Mm-hmm. But I, the Atma, I'm not losing weight. The body is losing weight. If I change my attitudes, follow Dharma, practice more kindness, my mind changes and is affected by those activities. I gain more shanti. The mind gains more shanti, not me. The mind gains more shanti. Those are all positive things within the creation and within the nature of the upadis, the conditioning adjuncts. These are all very, very positive things within duality, you know. But how are they improving or taking away from my being? Not at all, you know. They are all time-bound. I mean, within the creation as Ishwara, that I follow Dharma, you know, puts this jiva in harmony with the whole. And so this jiva blends in well, is taken care of by the whole, is taken care of by Ishwara, is not resisting. Ishwara is not kind of pushing you back into place, because you're pushing against the walls of Dharma or against the walls of your own prarabdha. And so Ishwara just knocks you back, you know? But if there's non-resistance, if there's just Dharma, then you find that life is much simpler. But that's true within duality, within the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, even from the standpoint of getting a better birth and all of these things. But even birth and death, birth and death, birth and death, birth and birth and death, that all comes and goes. This body comes and goes like a dress. You know, says that right away in chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says to Arjuna, you know, this body, when it gets worn out, we throw it away like an old dress and take a new one. You know, you can say that for every thought in the mind. You know, they come and go, and they come and go, and they come and go, and you remain. When you remain, that means you are not one of the objects that is playing off of each other. You know? And so, for me, really, you know, none of these things, Dharma and Adharma, you know, hot and cold. We say Dharma, Adharma, Sukha, Dukkha. Hot and cold, pleasure, pain. These dualities are effect, you know, the upadis that exist within time and space. But they don't affect me at all. A dharma, which is so painful within duality, has no effect on me at all. I'm the conscious being which illumines a dharma. I'm the conscious being that illumines Dharma. You know? That's why in the Katha Upanishad, and I guess the Bhagavad Gita also, this one verse goes something like this. If you think that you are the killer or the killed. You do not know yourself. If you think that you are the killer or the killed or the one who causes one to kill, you do not know yourself. They use the most extreme example. That's what using the extreme adharma to show the asangatvam of your own being, you know. But all of this has to do with your own experience, recognizing your own experience. It always has to land home. You know, you have to look inside and say, is this how it is? Am I coming and going? Can I recognize me, the one who is ever present to all of my experiences? And the more you understand, you recognize that and understand it logically, the more dominant you become, because now you've been differentiated from all of the things that come and go, that until that time you had just taken to be one. I am so unhappy. The I, the conscious being, and unhappiness go together. You know, I'm so angry. The I, conscious being, me, and anger go together. I'm so happy, things are finally going my way. You know, the I and that state of sukha go together. That's the samsara right there. There's no, the experience, the changeless experience of me is there because I am the one present to all of these emotions and thoughts. So that, I'm there, and all the emotions and thoughts are there, but the viveka is not there. The discrimination between me and all of the changing experiences and the repercussions of that understanding. That understanding has to come first in a way, and then that will lead to other understandings. It leads to non-duality. I have to get to a place where this is all nothing but me. And all of this is like the pot to the clay. This has no being apart from me. But to these understandings build upon that initial understanding. We can start with different initial understandings, but you have to start somewhere, and that's a good place to start. Because once you see that, you know, then you have to look at, well, what is the reality of these experiences that come in, into being and go out of being? What kind of reality is that? And how does it relate to me, myself, that is not an object that I can watch come into being and go out of being? All of these things, you have to see it and understand it. That's what knowledge is about. It's about an understanding of your experience. And in this case, it's not about gaining a new experience because you're already here. And the objectified world is already here too. You don't have to have a vision of the Ishvara Swarupa, the whole Ishvara. This is enough. Your prarabdha karma is Ishvara. Even though it's a limited piece of Ishvara, it's still this objectifiable reality composed of things that are infinitely divisible and come into being and go out of being. Whether you're analyzing the entire creation or just this little piece of it, it doesn't make any difference. If you understand this, that's enough. It's kind of like if you understand the relationship between one gold bangle, the gold and the bangle, you know, if you really get that, then all bangles, you know, all bracelets, the relationship between content and form, you know, is something known. Everything is infinitely, as in what we call an infinite extension. But it always has to come back to yourself, because this is self-knowledge. We're trying to understand who I really am, you know? That's not intellectual, because I'm here, you know? It's direct, immediate knowledge. It's not about the different lokas. All the lokas, all of the worlds that we experience and what goes on in that experience. And, you know, if I do this ritual, what happens? And, if I do all of these good acts, what type of a loka can I expect to get, and all of this? That's all knowledge of samsara. You know, that's indirect knowledge. We don't know. You have Shraddha in the Vedas or Shraddha in a text that you're studying. You gain indirect knowledge. This isn't indirect knowledge. I want self-knowledge, knowledge of me. I am here. So that's very different. And if I'm here, then my self-experience is here. Right? It's not I'm here, but I have no experience of myself. That's not true. You know? We just have to take off all of the clothing. The clothing is anything that can be objectified. And then if we just start that, what happens in this room? I mean, I do this as an exercise sometimes. We take off all, each one of us takes off all of our clothing, means every single thing that can be objectified, and then there is nothing left to make me different from you. Because those things have all been removed. So now there's not room for two of us, because there's no dividing. So I even objectify space, and so do you. So there's no way to make there be two beings. You've objectified time, you've objectified space, you've objectified your body and your mind and your sense organs and your experiences and your memories and your knowledges and your ignorances and your space and time, everything objectified. And then here you are, just me, with no time, with no space. The whole objectifiable universe has been objectified and differentiated from you. And we've all done that together. And then how many of us are there? This requires understanding. Because you're not going to look around and say, oh, there's only one of us. You're not going to look around. Because if you're looking around, you're looking into the duality. So this is a logical understanding, because it can't be any other way. You know, when you remove time and space, even to think, well, what size am I? What color am I? You know, how old am I? All of these things, they're totally meaningless. But this is a logical understanding. You know? If I am you, then I am Ishvara. Because if I can be you, that means all time, space, everything that exists within this creation has been objectified. It means there's only one of us, there's only one Ishvara. There's only one Atma, which is Brahman. Because there's nothing to divide the self. So there's only one self. So the self that I am is the self that Tibby is the self that Lucky is the self that you are, is the self that Little is. You know? Little Mister. All of us. It's only one self. So throughout the whole Bhagavad Gita, Bhagavan continues to say, I am the self in all beings, and all beings are in me. You know? But that's your mind needs to understand it, because you're not going to look at it. You are it. You can't look at it as an object. You see? So many things require your thought, and it's a type of thought and analysis that is non-negatable, because your experience will only support it. It won't negate it. That's why in the Shastra, for it to have jnana nishtha, for knowledge to really take place, to really be knowledge, first of all, you need a pramana. You need a means of knowledge. Means of knowledge means that means of knowledge is capable of giving me that particular knowledge. Like, for instance, my sense organs, eyes, for instance, are a means of knowledge for color. My ears are a means of knowledge for sound. That's what I rely on for sound. Inference is a means of knowledge for the different types of inference and presumption is one that I can make. These are established means of knowledge. Upanishad considers itself to be a pramana, a means of knowledge. So say we have the pramana, and the Shruti, it says, I am a valid means of knowledge. You say, well, how do I know that? Well, how do you know your eyes are a valid means of knowledge? You have to use them. Your ears, you have to use them. Inference, you have to use it. You have to understand it. The Shruti Pramana, you have to use it. But then if you use it, it should be supported and support your anubhava, your experience. It's not like you use the Shruti Pramana and it doesn't have anything to do with your experience. There's no way to relate the two. Then you just, well, the Shruti says this, but I don't have anything to attach it to. No, it has to be supported by your experience and supported by your logic. It's called Shruti, or Shruti, Yukti is logic, Anubhava is experience. All of these things have to work together, you know. You can have an experience and your logic can negate it, you know. If the Satthin is real, then both experience and logic will just continue to amplify it, to support it, you know. But that means whatever the Shastra has to say, it is talking about this anubhava, this experience here and now, right? And so whatever it has to say should be supported by your experience, and it should withstand any amount of logic. Logic will not get you to what the Upanishads have to reveal, but any amount of logic will support it, and any amount of logic will negate other positions. Both are important. If somebody says that something is true and it doesn't withstand logical analysis, you know, then how are you going to accept it? It doesn't hold true to your experience. It doesn't withstand logical analysis. That's why a debate is so alive and well in India. Because if you say something is true, you have to show me how is that true, and you have to be able to answer my questions. That's why, you know, Swamiji was never impatient around questions, because it's so much part of it. They're your questions for your depth of understanding. It's all really important for, because you want self-knowledge, you don't want an idea of what the Shruti says about the self. So it's a totally different. Yeah. So Jagadish says, how important is the personal relationship, the connection and the compatibility between the teacher and the student for the knowledge and the vision to be passed on? Well, you can have many different types of relationship with your teacher, you know. But what's important is that whatever the relationship is, it doesn't interfere with this teacher-student relationship of the passing of knowledge, you know. So say the teacher is teaching, the teacher is here, you're sitting there, the pramana is taking place, but the teacher is really irritating to you. And so you're not able to hear. You're not able to listen because your mind is distracted by some negative experience that you're having with that person. And so when that's the case, I mean, we all know that just in daily life, you have a bad relationship with somebody, and it's very hard to really listen to them. You don't even want to get near them, you know. You don't have any respect for them, to listen to them, all of that. So it's not so much about what kind of relationship that you have with the teacher, but whether or not you can listen with that open, you know, Swamiji will call it with that, like that gay abandon, uses that term, where there's just a total relaxation. There's no resistance to what you're listening. Questioning is not a resistance. Questioning is part of the teaching. It's part of learning. It's shravana manana. Shravana is also questioning about what the Shruti is actually saying here. Manana is questioning, saying, well, why couldn't it be like that? The Shruti says this, but couldn't it also be this way? That's manana. Shravana There's all kinds of questions in Shravana, trying to understand the vision of the Shruti, you know. Manana is, well, the Buddhists don't say that, the Buddhists say this, or the Sankhya doesn't say that, you know. Or I have a friend who believes this, or I had this doubt about, you know what I mean? Where you're actually kind of shaking the tree to see if the vision of the Vedas can, of the Upanishads can withstand your inquiry and your doubts. So does that make sense? Jagadisha, it's not one type of relationship. It's just that whatever your relationship is doesn't interfere with your being able to get this vision. That's the whole thing right there. There's so many different types of relationship. Mandukya.
Can you?
No, I don't remember. Though dukkha. I do. No, that's not dukkha.
Not
dukkha. No. You know what? I can actually look that up for you, because even though I'm sure Swamiji has also talked about it, but Paramarthananda gave a talk on the name of the Mandukya. I can find it and look it up. I just don't remember. Yeah. Mundaka, Mandukya. They have different meanings, and I don't remember. But I have it available, so I can find it for you. So Jagadisha says, so the open mind and respect is important. Yeah. I think so. Like, if you don't respect the teacher, your heart's not really open, you know. You don't have to make a big deal out of what type of respect in a simple form. How about you don't have any disrespect? You know? Or any disrespect that around. That's another thing. No disrespect around the teacher-student relationship. And around the teacher's ability to handle the pramana. I think that sometimes I think it's very important, and in the Hindu tradition, this used to be very protected. The teacher-student relationship was very protected and very, very formal. You know, and you didn't spend a lot of time kind of hanging out with your teacher and talking about this and that and this and that. It was all, there was so much respect. It was so formal. You served your teacher, you took care of your teacher, got the teacher whatever he needed and or she needed, and then made sure everything was comfortable in terms of creating the space for the teacher to come and give the teaching. You know, so it's all very formal, very, very formal. In fact, that's how it was when I went to India. You know, a lot of Westerners come in and having different expectations. It was used to be in the early 70s, it was so shocking to the Indian students, because Westerners always wanted to go in and have a private, personal talk with Swamiji, and they didn't want the door open because they didn't want anybody to hear, and all of this kind of stuff, which was just totally, and taking so much of Swamiji's time, we didn't even think about it like that, because we're more psychologically oriented, and we wanted to deal with our issues and all of this. They didn't ever even think like that, you know. So it caused, it really, the Western influence really kind of shook up the cultural protective container, you know, where the guru is almost like an archetype, a revered figure who you love and respect and honor, and you gain this knowledge from. And they kept that very, very protected, you know. So say when you start seeing how they interact with their politics, for instance. Like sometimes Swamiji was kind of a Republican. in some ways. And so what if somebody cared about that? Oh my God, he's a Republican? You know, he's not really a Republican or a Democrat, but he would take have Republican views. Then somebody could say, I don't want to study with a Republican. You know what I mean? Or how could he be a Jnani and be a Republican? You know? Or how could he be a Jnani and then he's talking about all of these politics and he's watching tennis all the time? How could he be a Jnani? He's watching tennis, you know? So all of this kind of stuff. So one of the things that I used to always tell my students and other students who came after me of Swamiji, don't ever get involved in any of that. You know, he's your guru.
Yeah.
Don't get involved in what we call this guru droha, talking negatively about your teacher or having somebody else, letting somebody else talk negatively about your teacher. Don't ever go there, you know, because this pramana is so sacred, you don't want to muddy the waters with this kind of gossip or caviling. And it says in the Shastra also, Shankara also talks about it, because you're the loser for it.
What?
You're the loser.
Yeah.
You're the loser because it's gossip and this bad mouthing and all of this is really infectious. So I just would never. Of course, I had a lot of Shraddha and Swamiji, but I would never let my. And those things took place. It was always kind of shocked me in a way. I was kind of a. I just wasn't there to engage in that. But I also didn't allow it, you know. Because this knowledge is so sacred. And you don't want to get into some sort of a relationship with somebody or with your teacher where you're expecting your teacher to be a wise person in areas way outside of this knowledge. It's not like the teacher. This is also something that I think in kind of modern, where the modern New Age Vedanta or New Age spirituality, where you think that somehow the teacher is omniscient somehow, and if they have self-knowledge, then of course whatever they say, you know, politically or everything else is also the truth, you know? And so you're looking for somebody who's like walking on water instead of somebody who really is a Mahatma in terms of this knowledge, you know? It's easy to do, to make that jump. They even have a verse about, you know, in Bhandarkar, the text that I usually teach in Sanskrit, two volumes, Sanskrit text, Bhandarkar.
Yeah.
There's one verse where they talk about this, it's just a two-line verse. Watch out for the wise person when he's talking about some other subject. Because even for the wise person, because they have so much depth in one area, they themselves can feel that they have depth in all areas. Yeah. So, anyway, this is all kind of tangential, but I think it's important and interesting. So Jagadish, you brought up all of this stuff for me in my mind. Let me get this. Martina.
Well, I found that true for myself, because when I first met Swamiji.
Oh, okay, Martino. Repeat the questions. Go ahead.
To verify what you said, I found the same thing true for myself, because when I met Swamiji, there were a couple topics that I didn't agree with him on. And I made the decision that I'm not going to lose Swamiji over these disagreements on topics. And so I just dropped it, you know.
Right. Which is the right thing to do, because that's not why you're there.
Yeah.
Martina Edward was just talking about his experience when he met Swamiji, which is in line with what we've been saying, That when he met Swamiji, there was a few things Swamiji was talking about, probably in politics or something, that Edward really didn't agree with at all, but he just made a decision that he's not going to go there. That's not important.
Yeah.
What's important is that he has this knowledge and he's your teacher, and so to stay there with this knowledge.
Yeah, I didn't want to lose Swamiji over two or three topics. It would have been silly.
Yeah. But that's also very mature, you know. The topics are all so relative,
yeah.
You know.
And now those topics are dated. They're all in the past, way back there, and don't even count.
Anyway, I hope this makes sense to everybody. Ask me if I'm confusing you. Don't let me confuse you.
Was there a thread about how in the past there was this formality, and now how is it?
Oh, so Sharda asks, is there some thread? Well, initially there was so much formality, and to now, how is it? I think how it is now is that, like, for somebody like Swamiji, and now really for any of the Indian Swamis, is that when I was there, there was only the most minimal influx of other cultures, like Westerners and hippies, you know, and kind of the New Age thing. That was really, they were just starting to be introduced to it. And so, and there was no psychology either to speak of. So that also, Swamiji really poo-pooed psychology completely. He thought this knowledge, wielding the pramana, was enough. That would take care of everything, you know, and he didn't have any use for psychology. Until he worked with a few Westerners, then he understood, I think there we need some psychology, and then he started studying it. So we got in at a time when, before there was a real influx of Westerners and a real influx of kind of pseudo-Vedanta and these pseudo type of spiritualities.
Papaji.
And so there's been kind of a cultural breakdown even on many of the so-called gurus. They're not really gurus. They're wearing orange and acting like gurus, but they're really not, actually. They don't deserve that title. And so there's been, over the decades, or every, say, five-year increments, kind of a breakdown of the culture because the West has really intruded itself upon the East, and the East is also coming over here. When I was first there, even to go to a movie was a big deal. You know, and the movies that we would get would be one movie theater, like in Bombay or two, and it would have some old movie on it, you know. And there was no TVs to speak of. I mean, if somebody had a TV, they were probably wealthy. And everybody wore saris, and the men wore dhotis, and everybody had long hair with a braid and tilak. You know, that's not true anymore. Now they get the same movies that we get on the days, same day that we get them, you know. And they all have TVs, and they get as many Western, programs as we get, and they get their Indian programs also.
And they're showing over here Hindi.
Yeah, so it's all a global mishmash, you know. It's just so the borders have broken down. So I'm sure there's positive things to that, but there's also things that have broken down the culture, you know. And also there's a lot of beggars who take orange. That's probably true before, but it's way true the last 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. Beggars wear orange because they're much more easy for them to get bhiksha. They're not a sannyasi at all. And Swamiji told me about this one, told us, not just me, about this one fellow who came and wanted Swamiji to teach him, give him sannyasa, and teach him a few verses from the Gita, so that he could go and teach the Westerners and become famous in the States. And Swamiji said, no, you sit. I'll teach you the whole Gita. No, no, just a few verses, Swamiji. That's all I need. That's all just a level of removal from being removed from the culture. See what I mean? Where you, like levels and layers and layers and layers of being kind of, over time, losing the strength of the culture. So Maitreya says, what is the difference in significance of those who wear orange and those who wear white? Well, orange means that you've actually taken sannyasa, you've taken the vows. White or yellow means you're, those are the colors, either two of those colors are used for brahmacharya, which means you've taken preliminary vows. The vows of brahmacharya means that, you know, it's like in the Catholic Church, for a nun becomes a novitiate first, and it takes, has to do that for 8 years or so before they actually take their final vow. So brahmacharya, you commit yourself to study with an intent to taking sannyas, but you can change your mind. You know, that's your intention, but when it comes time to take those vows, then you might say, I don't think so. But once a sannyasi, always a sannyasi, because of the nature of the vows. Even if you were to give up the orange, you can't give up the sankalpa you made. It's a very powerful sankalpa. Hmm. Yeah.
That's true within the Swami order of Swami Shankaracharya. But like this fellow up here, Baba Haridas, he's a Vairagi, and all Vairagis wear white. I didn't know that. Hmm.
But a Vairagi, does he call himself a sannyasi?
He
calls himself a Vairagi.
He's also a sannyasi. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with that. Usually the sannyasis wear orange, but maybe it's a different type.
Different sadhu orders.
Yeah. Regarding psychology, in the last few years, Pooja Swamiji had asked some people to get therapy first and then study. He must have felt that they just really weren't ready, and they had some issues that they had to deal with before it would be beneficial for them to come and actually sit in the course. He wouldn't let you come and sit in a course if he felt like you had to do something first. Then he would just, if he's your teacher and he knows you, and then he says, what is best, this is what is best for you. Before you, this course would be useful, do this. Then if that student has, if he's the guru for that student, then that student should do that, or at least have a serious discussion. I don't believe in blindly doing something, but I think it's helpful to take whatever, I always took whatever Swamiji said very seriously. I didn't feel like I had to do everything he said, like, nor does he like to give advice. But then because of who he is and his experience, what he said, if I didn't understand it, I would really think about it, sit with it. Well, most of the things I agreed with. Okay. Any last questions before we say goodnight? Okay, everybody.